Brethren, the story of this world, our world, begins in darkness. Genesis says the earth was without form and void, all covered by the oceans, a water planet covered by clouds so thick that no light could penetrate. And it says darkness was on the face of the deep. Darkness. What emotions or what thoughts does that word elicit for you? Human beings fear darkness when we cannot see what may be out there in front of us. We fear the unknown, and darkness is a time of the unknown. As adults, most of the time, we learn to harness that fear. But if you remember as a child, you probably instinctively were afraid of the dark. I remember being afraid of the dark when I had to go into my bedroom, which I didn't share with anybody, and then the lights were turned off and it was dark. I was afraid. What? Maybe there were monsters under the bed. You remember worrying about things like that? I did. Some of my friends told me they believed if they could just run to the bed and pull the covers over their head, they would be safe from whatever might lurk under the bed. I thought that was foolish. I said, the covers are over your head. You're not going to see anything coming toward you. So I always kept the covers just below my eyes. So if there was something there, at least at the last minute, I would see it. I wanted to be able to see it coming. So imagine that scene that I've just described to you in the beginning of the book of Genesis. An entire planet of raging seas in a Stygian darkness. That is the beginning of the story of the creation of humankind, the recreation of this planet and the creation of humankind. It says in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, let's read it, although you probably could recite it from memory, but I want to underline a couple of words here that will be important to our subject of today. Genesis chapter 1, starting in verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. Then God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw the light, that it was good, and God divided the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So the evening and the morning were the first day. The Bible opens with a dark planet. And the next thing that happens is that God spoke and commanded there to be light, and it was so. He spoke the word, and it happened. We're going to see today that the Bible starts the story in darkness, but the end of the story is going to be in light. A light far greater than the light that comes from our sun today. There will be a light that will banish darkness, not just relegate darkness to the hours of the night, but banish it utterly and forever. The images of day and night, darkness and light, are key concepts in the Bible. They are leitmotifs that run from Genesis all the way through to Revelation. Probably there are references coming to your minds right now. Christians are called children of light. We are told to walk in the light. We're told to put off the works of darkness. So I propose that we explore that during the time of the sermon today. Let's see what we can learn in the Bible from this idea of day and night and light and darkness. And I'm going to be using historical information that I have pulled from a book which I found quite interesting and read a couple of months ago, At Day's Close, Night in Times Past by A. Roger Ekirk. What this author did was he went through historical records, starting with the classical period of the Greeks and the Romans, going through the history of Europe, and he found documents that mentioned what happened at night in history. What did people do? How did they sleep? What were they afraid of? And these are all based on primary documents, so court records, when people gave testimony, or other things that were written down. It's really a fascinating read about how people looked at the night in times past, and many of these stories are going to illustrate principles that we're going to find in the scripture about lightness and darkness and day and night. Let's start with the first one in Psalm 91. Psalm 91, starting in verse 1. Psalm 91, verse 1. He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday. These all represented things people feared in times past at the time that David was meditating on these things. He said there was a terror by night. There was a pestilence that walked by night, but that those who followed the Eternal did not need to fear those evils because they could dwell in the secret place of the Most High. And we'll talk a little bit more about what that means in just a moment. The terror that walked by night. Historically, the darkness was a dangerous time. People could not see, or at best they could only see very dimly. Shadows that appeared at night appeared supernatural. Almost all cultures historically believed that demons roamed the night. It was the realm of Satan, who worked in darkness. What if one day the sun set and never rose again, leaving mankind to perish in the cold and the darkness? That was a fear in many primitive societies. And then there were robbers and murderers abroad. Sunset, as the light of the day faded, was called the shutting in time, when you locked your door and barred your windows and you closed yourself off as much as you could for the night. It was a time of fear, a terror that walks by night. One man wrote in 1670, rather, he wrote, "We lie in the shadow of death at night. Our dangers are so great." That was a European. That's what people thought when the sunset and the shutting in time began. In Shakespeare's long poem, Lucrece, the title character talks of the night. "O comfort-killing night, image of hell, dim register and notary of shame, black stage for tragedies and murders fell, vast sin-concealing chaos, nurse of blame, blind muffled bawd, dark harbor for defame, grim cave of death, whispering conspirator with closed-tongued treason and the ravisher." That was Shakespeare's thought on what happened in the night. There was much to fear, this terror by night. The night was a frightening time. The night sky could be frightening all by itself because events were not understood. No one understood the science behind lightning or comets or meteors or the aurora borealis or passing planets or lunar eclipses. And all of those things would have been much clearer back then because there was no light pollution, as we call it today. There were no cities that dimmed what happened in the sky. So everything would have been vivid. And there was no understanding of what caused these things. They seemed to happen at random, and no one knew why. The moon brought welcome light, of course. But as people knew, and they knew from early times, from the classical period, that it was the moon that pulled the waters of the seas back and forth, causing tides, they imagined that it did the same thing to fluids in our bodies. So they believed that phases of the moon could affect people the way they thought. They believed it could affect the brain. And so we have expressions like someone being moonstruck or someone becoming a lunatic. Loon is the French word for moon. So we got that word from French. A lunatic is someone who's crazy because of the effect the moon has had on his brain. People feared evil spirits and witches. And even the disciples of Jesus Christ, there's an example of them having such a fear when something happened at night that they did not understand. Turn to Matthew 24, please. Matthew 14. Misread that. Matthew 14, verse 25. So if you read verses 24 and 25, you'll see it was the fourth watch of the night, and there's a storm in the middle of the sea. The disciples are in a boat on the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus, who's been praying, decides it's time to rejoin them, and so he walks out on the waters of the sea. There are several examples of him doing that. The fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. Verse 26, and when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a ghost!" And they cried out in fear. These were big, burly men. Fishermen were well-muscled. These were strong men. But in the darkness and things that they don't understand, they knew there was no such thing as ghosts. When you see something you don't understand, irrational fears can take over. They cried out for fear. The night air was sometimes believed to be noxious. And in fact, we now know that because of medical research that's been done, death is more likely to occur in the early morning hours than other times of the day due to circadian rhythms peculiar to conditions like asthma or heart attack or stroke due to blood clots. More people die in the early hours of the morning than at other times of the day. We become more vulnerable when our circadian rhythms are at their lowest ebb. But historically, people didn't understand circadian rhythms. They just attributed it to the night. Night is when more people died. So there was a pestilence, they thought, that walked by night. There were criminals afoot. And the darker the night, the more dangerous it was. Sometimes people had to try to walk home in the dark. They got caught away from their homes, and in walking home, they would become disoriented. People fell into holes or got lost. And many historically fell into ponds and lakes and rivers and drowned because they couldn't see. And there was a very great fear of fire, because that was the only light that anyone had. It was a world lit entirely by fire. Nothing brighter than a candle or something in the fireplace. And if you've been around a fireplace or a campfire, or if you've tried to walk around with a lantern, you know how dim that light is. You really can't see very well. But the fire itself posed dangers at night. There was a great fear of fire. A fire could destroy whole villages or whole towns. You probably heard of the Great Fire of London, which broke out on Sunday, September 2nd, 1666, a little after midnight. A fire broke out at Thomas Farriner's Bakery in Pudding Lane in London. It burned for 4 days and destroyed almost the entire central area of London. Anything within the old Roman wall, which still existed at the time, was burned. And it's remembered yet today. If you walk through central London, you'll see plaques on some buildings. This building survived the fire of 1666. Or the fire came this far and stopped here, went no farther. And there are, in central London, there are some restaurants and a few buildings that survived the fire, and they've got plaques on them. And people go and eat in restaurants, and they think, wow, this survived the fire of 1666. Here we are in our day and age now, and people still have a memory of that fire, of how great it was. Authorities sometimes rang bells to order a curfew, where people had to go back home. Our word curfew comes from the French word couvre-feu, which means literally cover your fire. That was the time when people were ordered to put the fires out, at least their work fires, because of the dangers that they represented at night. All those dangers that people saw in the darkness. We see dangers around us as well. There are things that are dangerous to us. Terrorism, crime, disease that can occur to us. We deal with these things. But David assures us that when we dwell in the secret place of the Most High, we don't need to fear any of those things. What is the secret place of the Most High? Well, it's his protection. And it's secret because nobody else can see it. We walk in a protected zone in our lives. And it's a secret. It's a mystery to people who don't know God and don't know what the Bible teaches about the relationship Christians have with their Father in heaven. We need fear, none of that. We can live our lives without fear as children of the light because we dwell under the wings of the Most High and in a place of secret protection invisible to almost everyone. We can live our lives as children of the light without fear of the unknown. Now, none of us conquers fear entirely. I know that. But as Christians, we can be very confident. We live our lives in the palm of our Father's hand, and nothing happens to it unless He decides it's going to be for our best in the end. We can walk without fear of the unknown, without fear of outward threats, without fear of disease, because we know in the end, whatever happens in the middle of the story, the ending is going to be the most happy possible. So that's one thing we can learn that the Bible teaches us about light and darkness. Darkness represented a time of danger. And David said, I can live in the secret place of the Most High. And so can you and I. Whatever dangers we may face in this life, just make sure we stay in the secret place of the Most High. What else can we learn from the analogy of light and dark in the Bible? Well, let's look at Joshua chapter 1, verse 8. Joshua chapter 1, verse 8. So the book of Joshua begins, it says in verse 1 of chapter 1, after the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now arise and go over the Jordan, you and all this people, to the land that I'm giving them to the children of Israel. Down in verse 8, it says something that was a key to Joshua being successful in his life and as a leader in Israel. God told him, direct quote from God, instruction from God, this book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. You shall meditate in it day and night. Meditate in it day and night. What does that mean? How should we understand that? Well, David shed some light on this idea in the Psalms. In Psalm 63, verse 6, David wrote, when I remember you on my bed, I meditate on you in the night watches. I meditate on you in the night watches. And Psalm 119, verse 148, Psalm 119, verse 148, David wrote, my eyes are awake through the night watches, that I may meditate on your word. What were the night watches? You ever wonder about that? Did David just decide to wake up in the middle of the night so he could watch for a while? Actually, this is one of the most interesting things I found in this book. Until recently, until the Industrial Revolution, it was not normal for a human being to sleep straight through 8 hours or 9 hours or whatever we think of as normal now. Throughout most of human history, it was not that way. You can find references in classical period, Plutarch, Pausanias from the classical period, and other quotes from the Middle Ages found in European courts of law and others show that for most of human history, there are actually two periods of sleep. There was what they called, what almost everybody called, first sleep and second sleep. And they were separated by an hour or two or three. So people would go to bed around sundown when things got dark. They'd sleep till, say, midnight. And then they'd wake up, and they'd be up for a couple of hours, and then they would have second sleep, and they would go back to sleep again. References from the 1200s show that people would sleep about that period, get up for 2 or 3 hours, and then go back to bed until the morning. So there was a night watch through most of human history. There was a period of time when people woke up, and they got up out of bed, and they did things in the house. Sometimes they drank, or they smoked, or they talked, or they did whatever they were going to do during that period of time until sleep came once again, and then they would go back to bed. There may be a reference to this break in the middle of the night in the book of Judges, talking about Samson. Can't guarantee you that that's what this is, but it looks very much like it. It fits this understanding of first sleep and second sleep. Judges 16, verse 3. Judges 16, verse 3. Samson lay low till midnight. So was he sleeping? Was that his first sleep? He laid down in his bed until midnight. You see that the word lo is in italics here. That means that's been added by the translators for clarity. So that's not actually in the original text. So it actually says, if we leave that out, Samson lay till midnight. So I think it's reasonable to assume he was sleeping until midnight. Then he arose, maybe after his first sleep, at midnight, took hold of the doors of the gate of the city and the two gateposts, pulled them up, bar and all, put them on his shoulders, and carried them up to the top of the hill that faces Hebron. I can't guarantee you, I can't prove 100% that this was a break after his first sleep, but it does fit what we know of how people slept through most of human history. What finally ended that, when we started sleeping or thinking it's normal to sleep all the way through the night, was the Industrial Revolution, when people were working very, very long hours in trying jobs, and they were so exhausted by the end of the day, they slept straight through. It also has to do with the arrival of very bright lights. That makes it harder for us to sleep. And I'll talk more about that a little later on in the sermon. David says, and perhaps that's an instruction to Joshua as well, meditate on it day and night. David said he spent the night watches meditating on the law of God and meditating on God. So, as I said, people would get up and socialize, do domestic work. The church encouraged people to pray. So that's why there were certain prayers in the Catholic monasteries. The monks were supposed to get up and pray during that period of time. They would get up every night and do that. But we know that this phenomenon of first sleep and second sleep, we have records of it going back to the Roman period. So this isn't just something that the church imposed. It seems to be natural. Older people today sometimes find they don't sleep all the way through the night either. They revert to this pattern of waking up in the middle of the night for a while before they can get back to sleep. So if that's the case for you, maybe you're just going back to what's normal rather than doing something that's abnormal. I don't know if that's much comfort to you in the middle of the night, but you may be actually doing it the way God made us to do that. When I told my parents about this, we love to converse about books that we're reading, and I explained this about first sleep and second sleep. I said, well, that's nothing new to us. We've been doing that for years. You know, we wake up in the middle of the night and talk, and before we can get back to sleep again. That's actually more normal for human beings than sleeping 8 hours. That's only been a development for the last 200 years or so. So what's the lesson about this? David particularly decided he was going to use those night watches to think about God and to reflect on his word, to think on things that were valuable to him spiritually. And I believe that is an important lesson for us. The lesson is to meditate on God's law whenever we have the chance, to make it an important part of our day. And, if the occasion arises, an important part of our night. It should never be far from our minds. Day, night, whenever we come in, whenever we go out, whenever we rise up, and whenever we lie down, as it says in Deuteronomy, we shall have his law in our hearts. And there are times, or special times, when we have the occasion to do that. The Sabbath is a wonderful time to meditate on God's law and who he is and what he is and what he does in our lives, because we rest from our labors. And it's important to use some of that best time we have in order to turn our thoughts to God and to fill our minds with his word and his law. That's what God told Joshua. That's what David said he himself did. A lesson from day and night. A third lesson we can learn in the Bible from this analogy. The darkness of night is compared to evil works, the works of darkness. And I think we can understand why that is. Most evil things happen at night or in darkness when no one can see what the ne'er-do-well is going to do. No one can see the sin that's going to be committed. He's invisible in the darkness of night. In John chapter 9, verse 4, John chapter 9, verse 4. Jesus used this analogy a great deal concerning his ministry and what he was about. He said in John 9, 4, I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. And in those days, almost no one could work at night. Any kind of trade that you had, any kind of skill that you were going or ability that you were going to use to try to earn your living, that pretty much ceased at sundown. the light of a candle or the light of a rush would be too dim to be able to do very much. And most people could not afford to light up things in their house at night. It was expensive to do that by their standards. So everything just came to a close. And Jesus used that as an analogy. I have a window of opportunity now to do the work of God. Soon the sun is going to set and I won't be able to do his work anymore. There's another interesting example of this analogy in Proverbs chapter 7. Proverbs 7, verse 6. Proverbs chapter 7, verse 6. At the window of my house, I looked through my lattice and saw among the simple. Now, if we were to update this with modern language, simple at that time, we would say stupid today. I saw among the stupid, or the foolish, if you will. I perceived among the youths a young man devoid of understanding, an ignorant young man. Passing along the street near her corner, he took a path to her house in the twilight, in the evening, in the black and dark night. And there a woman met him with the attire of a harlot and a crafty heart. She was loud and rebellious. Her feet would not stay at home. At times she was outside and times in the open square, lurking in every corner. So she caught him and kissed him with an impudent face and said to him, I have peace offerings with me. Today I have paid my vows. So I came out to meet you diligently to seek your face, and I have found you. I've spread my bed with tapestry, and so on and so forth. A young man going out in the black and dark night. In the black and dark night. That's when the works of darkness happen. And so it is today. A lot of criminal behavior, a lot of immoral behavior is going to happen at night when people are cloaked by the darkness and others cannot see what it is that they do. A census of the year 1526 revealed that 10% of the 55,000 residents of Venice in Italy were ladies of the night. 10% of the population practiced prostitution, and that happens almost entirely at night. In the 18th century town city of Paris, journeymen and apprentices, so those who were learning trades, would go out and become thieves at night. They committed two-thirds of all the petty thefts in the city of Paris, according to police records. These were people with jobs. But hey, we'll just supplement the revenue a little bit. We'll go knock someone on the head and take his purse. People's behavior changed at night, and still today. I'm sure you've witnessed some examples of that, how people's behavior changes. Some people's behavior changes at night. Fine, upstanding citizens during the daytime, and something else is happening after dark. Turn to Ephesians chapter 5 now, if you would. Ephesians chapter 5, starting in verse 8. Ephesians chapter 5, verse 8. For you were once darkness. He didn't say you were in the darkness. He said you were darkness. Now you are light in the Lord. Walk as children of the light. For the fruit of the Spirit is in all goodness, righteousness, and truth, proving what is acceptable to the Lord. And have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather expose them. For it is shameful even to speak of those things which are done by them in secret. But all things that are exposed are made manifest by the light, for whatever makes manifest is light. Therefore, he says, awake, you who sleep, arise from the dead, and Christ will give you light. Arise, Christ will give you light. So, that's an important lesson to learn from what the Bible says about darkness and light. We must never forget, always remember that we are children of the light. We too were darkness at one point until God entered our lives and began to work with us and get us on a different path. Now we are children of the light, and we must act accordingly and have no fellowship with the works of darkness. Not get caught up in any way with the darkness of the world. Not do anything when people can't see us that we would be ashamed to do if they could see us. We are children of the light. A fourth lesson that the Bible teaches about this, it specifically says children of the light are temperate. They are balanced. They are temperate. And specifically, they refuse strife. They don't like to get into fights or arguments. And they refuse envy. They don't want in an inordinate way what someone else has, or think it's unfair that they don't have what that person has, and maybe there's a way I can get some of that for myself. Children of the light are temperate. They refuse strife and envy. Historically, night was a big time for strife and envy. That's when a lot of it came out. Night was the time when those who had to submit to others during the day, that might be apprentices or servants, sometimes even just teenagers who didn't like to have to obey their parents, they would sometimes take their revenge at night. The Boston theologian Cotton Mather wrote and condemned knots of riotous young men that roamed the city at night. He listed some of their names, and one of them was his own son. Knots of riotous young men out doing mischief at night. In Germany, a Protestant synod protested, quote, "Decent people can no longer be sure of anything and must face the most shameful insults, even physical attacks, at night in their country." Of London, a certain Sir William Davenant said in 1673, "Our city, famed for government, is by these nightly riots and disorders grown less safe than galleys," those ships which slaves would row, "grown less safe than galleys where revolted slaves enchain their officers." Night was a time when the established order was overturned. In the French city of Dijon in the 15th century, craftsmen and workers became notorious for collective rapes, up to 20 a year. It was estimated at the time that half of the adult male population would have participated in those when they were adolescents. Those are the kinds of things that happened at night. A Scottish proverb said, "He that does ill hates the light." Easy enough to understand. He who does ill wants to be invisible while he does it, and so that happens at night. On the other hand, Romans 13, verse 12, says something different. Romans 13, verse 12. Romans chapter 13, starting in verse 12. "The night is far spent, the day is at hand. Therefore, let us cast off the works of darkness, and let us put on the armor of light. Let us walk properly, as in the day, not in revelry and drunkenness, not in licentiousness and lewdness, not in strife and envy." Those are all things associated with darkness. Drunkenness, revelry, licentiousness, and lewdness, that means improper sexual behavior. Not in strife, not arguing or fighting with people, and not in envy. That's something we have to be very careful about, because our society, Western society, is growing darker in the spiritual sense of things. People love to fight and argue now. Social media is a huge battlefield for that sort of thing. And they love to be envious of other people. It's not fair that you have what you have. I deserve some of that. We're going to make laws to switch it around and take some from these people and give it to these people. Strife and envy are increasingly common. And we swim in that sea. We have to be very careful not to let that rub off on us. As children of the light, we must reject the ways of the world that are mentioned in these verses here in Romans 13. Debauchery, of course, of all kinds, but also quarrels, fights, whether they be verbal or other kinds. As I said, our world is becoming more and more quarrelsome, and they're proud of it. People are proud when they insult someone else. "Look what I did. Look who I hurt." Our political discourse has never been good-natured in the United States, ever. If you go back to the Founding Fathers and read some of the things some of them said about each other, that wasn't a good example. But what we're seeing today goes far beyond things that we've seen before. And it is more and more acceptable in many people's eyes. Jealousies of all kinds are highlighted. Jealousies between ethnicities, between people with more or less money, between people who have more education, people who have less education, between political parties. You can't spend very much time on Twitter without seeing some horrible language being used about other people. And those are supposed to be the thought leaders of the nation. That's the direction they're going. That's another part of the works of darkness that we must avoid. Avoid getting caught up in these currents. Envy, strife, because they are works of darkness, not works of light. That's lesson four. Children of the light are temperate, and they reject strife and envy. A fifth lesson that the Bible teaches, using this analogy of light and dark, is that as children of the light, we're fruitful, that is, our work is productive, because we walk in the light, because we walk in God's way and we walk in His law, that makes the outcome of our efforts more fruitful. I'm going to turn to John chapter 8. Start reading in verse 12. John chapter 8, verse 12. John 8, 12, then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life. The light of life, a guarantee from God when we are submissive to Him that we'll inherit eternal life. We have that light to guide our path. That's our ultimate destination. That's where we're going. The light of life. Things began to change in Europe and in North America in the 18th century, the 1700s, and even more in the 1800s. The Age of Enlightenment had advanced science education. They began to understand things like lightning and what was happening in the sky at night, so there was less fear about that. More educated people rejected superstition. They rejected belief in magic. They also rejected the Catholic Church. For associated reasons. There were fewer and fewer trials for witchcraft. Used to be lots of trials for witchcraft when people were superstitious about things. That all started really tapering off in the 18th and especially the 19th century. That was almost over. Economic growth allowed more lighting in cities at night, so the night began to lose some of its fearfulness. The Industrial Revolution meant that factories were operating 24/6. Not 24/7, people got the Lord's Day off, but 24/6, and so factories were running all the way through the night. And social life began to evolve also. There began to have more and more activities in the evening and then at night. By the 19th century, the streets of large cities were lit by lamps that burned coal gas, which was much brighter than a flame would have been. This was happening in London and Paris and Berlin and Baltimore, and other big American cities. The number of night watchmen was increased to make the night safe for good people. Paris formed the Guard, the first professional police force that began in Paris, and that happened in the period we're talking about. So people could begin to live and work even at night. And it was around this time that the two sleeps, first sleep and second sleep, began to merge, and there was just one period of sleep, because the bright lights that people saw, when you see a bright light, that wakes you up, and through the night, increasingly, it became a brighter, less dim place. John chapter 9, verse 4. I must work the works of Him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva. He anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay, and he healed him. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. He was the epitome of goodness, of God's way, of obedience to God's law. He was the perfect example of what that looks like when it's put into practice perfectly. He set an example that changes our lives still today, 2,000 years later, and will continue to do so until his return to earth. He is the light of the world. John chapter 11, verse 10. John chapter 11, verses 9 and 10. Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of the world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." If we walk in darkness, if we walk in the darkness of the world, we're going to stumble spiritually. We're going to fall. We're not going to have success. Our efforts are fruitful and successful. God blesses them because we walk in the light of his law. We walk in the light of his will. Because if one walks in the night, he stumbles. Then the light's not in him and he can't see where he's going. And as we mentioned before, many, many accidents happened at night because people couldn't see where they were going. It's probably happened to all of us. Have you ever gotten up in the middle of the night and decided, I'm not going to wake up my wife or my husband, I'm not going to turn the light on, and wham, we walk into the door, we stub our toe on something? That's an example. That's the example Jesus is using here. You walk in the darkness, you're going to hurt yourself. If we walk in spiritual darkness, we're going to hurt ourselves, and we're going to hurt other people as well. John 12. John 12, verse 35. John chapter 12, verse 35. "A little while longer, the light is with you. Walk while you have the light, lest darkness overtake you. He who walks in darkness does not know where he is going. While you have the light, believe in that light, that you may become sons of light." These things Jesus spoke and departed and was hidden from them. We must be sons and daughters of light. And if we walk in that light, our work, our efforts are going to bear fruit. They're going to be fruitful. We're going to have success in what we set our hands to do. If we don't do that, if we decide to walk in the darkness, or we get distracted and we end up walking in the darkness without really paying that much attention, the results won't be good. They'll be painful and troubling. So Jesus Christ must be the light that shows us our way. And we must take every opportunity that we have that arises to do the work of God, to work and to walk in the light while we have the light. A sixth and final lesson that I will try to underscore for us here as we go through this is all of what we've talked about thus far. The five previous lessons that we've pulled from the Bible or have jumped out at us from the Bible about this analogy of day and night and light and dark, all of this we apply so that our final destination can be what the Bible calls the kingdom of light. We are going toward something the Bible calls the kingdom of light, or the inheritance of the saints in the light. There are different translations of this phrase. I'm talking about Colossians chapter 1, verses 9 to 14. Colossians chapter 1, verses 9 to 14. I'm going to read this to you in the New International Version, and then we'll read it again in the New King James Version. "For this reason, since the day we heard about you, we have not stopped praying for you. We continually ask God to fill you with the knowledge of his will through all the wisdom and understanding that the Spirit gives, so that you may live a life worthy of the Lord and please him in every way, bearing fruit in every good work, growing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, so that you may have great endurance and patience, and giving joyful thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of his holy people in the kingdom of light. for he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. We look at verses 12 and 13 in the New King James, giving thanks to the Father who has qualified us to be partakers of the inheritance of the saints in the light. He has delivered us from the power of darkness and translated us into the kingdom of the Son of his love. So depending on how you translate it, this passage talks about us going toward the kingdom of light. And that's talking about light in the spiritual sense. He rescued us from the dominion of darkness, brought us into another kingdom, one we look forward to, one we have just recently celebrated during the Feast of Tabernacles. And we think about the end of the story as it's given to us in the Bible. We go to the end of the book of Revelation. We see literally a kingdom of light, a kind of light that the world has never yet seen, but that it will see at the return of Christ and after the millennium. Revelation chapter 21. Let's go and read the end of the story. We started at the beginning of the story in Genesis 1 with darkness. Now let's go and read the end of the story, and we'll see what kind of light we can anticipate, look forward to. Revelation chapter 21, verse 25, talking about the glory of the new Jerusalem. Its gates shall not be shut at all by day, and it will always be day. There will be no night there. So it's not just that the hours of darkness are relegated to, you know, the nighttime, as God did in Genesis. Now there's no night at all. There will be no night in the New Jerusalem. It will always be light. Revelation chapter 22, verse 5. There shall be no night there. They need no lamp nor light of the sun, for the Lord God gives them light, and they shall reign forever and ever. The Lord God will be the source of that light, going to shine forth from him. We celebrate this kingdom of light, light in the spiritual sense, light in the physical sense, although that won't have much meaning for us anymore. At this period, we won't need anything physical then. But it will be a time of light, both literal and figurative, the light of God's way. We just celebrated that during the Feast of Tabernacles. This, brethren, is our ultimate destination. This is our destiny. And this is our mission, what we aim for, what we strive toward every day of our lives. So I would encourage us all to think about these truths, to meditate on them in the night watches, so to speak. The opposition of darkness to light, how we live in a world of darkness, that we must let our light shine, that we must walk as children of the light, the reflection of the light of God that is in us through his Spirit. And we should remember that as children of the light, we should be fearless. We should meditate on the law of God day and night. We should do good and not evil. We should be temperate, not striving or envious. We should be confident that our work, our effort, the work of this lives will be fruitful. God's going to give us good reward for what we do in his name. And all of that so that our final destination can be the kingdom of light forever. We saw at the beginning of the sermon that human history began in darkness. Then God sent light. The end of our story will be in eternal light, in the kingdom of light, of which God himself will be the source. So let us all rejoice in this truth and walk as children of light.